are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. Broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.
Some of the events referred to may already have happened. In this segment of our show, Wendy Davis will be telling us a little bit about her work with assistive technology. So what can you tell me about the foundation and your work with assistive technology?
Sure. So I'm Wendy Davis. I'm the Director of Marketing and Outreach for Pennsylvania Assistive Technology Foundation. We are a statewide nonprofit that helps people get funding for assistive technology. And we are a federally authorized program, so we use the federal definition of assistive technology, which basically means we don't get an Excel spreadsheet of what is approved items for assistive technology. People come to us and tell us how an item or a service will make their life better, and that is assistive technology for them.
So what are some of the common needs? What are some of the most requested technologies?
So, number one phone call we get is for funding for hearing aids. Insurance, health insurance covers very little, if anything, for hearing aids. And hearing aids can be quite expensive. Now, there are over-the-counter hearing aids, but they're really only prescribed for mild hearing loss. So for moderate through to profound hearing loss, you really need to work with an audiologist or hearing instrument specialist for special programmed hearing aids. And those can run anywhere from, you know, around $1,000 to, well, recently we got a quote for $10,000 for a pair of hearing aids. So hearing aids is an item that we get calls about frequently. The second item that we get a lot of calls for funding is adaptive vehicles, because they are so expensive and there are very few funding sources available for adaptive vehicles. In the state of Pennsylvania, as in many other states, our Office of Vocational Rehabilitation will help people with disabilities who are seeking employment or who are employed. They will help them with an adaptive vehicle. They can pay for adaptations to a vehicle, but not with the purchase of the vehicle to be adapted. And that can be very expensive because only certain vehicles will meet the criteria for adaptations. We work very closely with our Office of Vocational Rehabilitation. They refer people to us. And we, our financial loans, we can go up to $60,000. Those can be used for the purchase of the vehicle to be adapted. So, you know, a lot of the assistive technology that we get calls about are basic things that people need every day just to live their lives, to live independently, go to work, go to school, be active in their community. But it's really a very wide range of things that people can get funding for as assistive technology.
So how do you reach out to folks to let them know that your work exists and you can be a source of support?
It's a tough job. That is an ongoing task of trying to make people aware that we are that we're here, that we can help them with funding. So we work a lot with partner organizations, so that they can refer their clients. For example, working with some rehab centers or medical centers, someone all of a sudden has a change in their health status, and all of a sudden they need a home modification. They're bringing home someone from a hospital in a wheelchair, and they cannot gain access to the home. We also get referrals from assistive technology vendors, like adaptive vehicle vendors, when they have clients that are having difficulty finding the funds to get a vehicle. They will refer their clients to us. Stair lifts, another one. We get a lot of referrals from vendors of stair lifts. Our Office of Vocational Rehabilitation refers clients to us. So we work a lot with partner organizations, but we also do a lot of work of direct-to-consumer because there are many people out there who have health conditions and disabilities, but they don't consider themselves part of the disability community, and they're not connected to a lot of partner organizations. So we do a lot of work to reach them where they are. We'll go to resource fairs, senior events, to try to connect with them directly to let them know that this is a resource available to them.
So in your time doing this work, is there any success moment or story that stands out for you you'd like to share?
Oh, goodness. There are so many. We just had a webinar Wednesday night, the Real Life Stories, Building a Comfortable Smart Home. And it was really exciting to see people interacting on the chat. And we had people from around the world. We had someone from London who had joined us real time. We also had a lot of people within the United States. And one of the participants was talking about they were in the midst of designing an accessible space for someone with a disability. And being able to, provide them information at this stage about different ways to implement smart home technology and talk about different funding sources that are out there to help them pay for this, that kind of stuff is always really rewarding.
So when you say smart home technology, what would this include?
So it's a lot of things that people use connected to Alexa that some people might not even use that terminology, smart home technology, or, they're just smart devices. But these devices can be so powerful for people that are looking to age in place or who want to live independently with a disability. They can be really, game changers. I was just on a meeting presentation talking about people with low vision and blindness. And, nowadays a lot of our appliances have like a digital display, and it's like these smooth screens that you have to see to touch the button to say, well, I want to cook this on microwave for 1 minute and at half strength, whatever, but there's no physical button for you to touch. Now there are devices, appliances on the market that have smart home technology integrated into that appliance at no extra cost. It's just part of the regular model. And you can now control a lot of appliances with your voice. And that is such a game changer for so many different populations. People who are low vision or blind, people that have mobility disabilities. So is there everything from appliances to just your basic smart speaker? Alexa can do so much to help people, set reminders for appointments or to take medication. For people with intellectual disabilities, especially parents who have children with intellectual disabilities, they can use that to set reminders for their kids so that their children can start to build more independence, not being so reliant on their parents, to remind them of things, even just reminding kids, to do chores or to remember to take their library book. It's Thursday. They need to remember to take their library book to school. It's a wide array of devices and the way that we can use them. And I recommend anyone who's interested in exploring that in more depth to visit our smarthomesmadesimple.org website. And we have a guide that's available to download free of charge that talks about using smart home technology as assistive technology. And there is a self-assessment included in that that helps people look at their activities of daily living, very much like an OT or occupational therapist, and sort of identify where are your challenges on a daily basis. Do you have challenges controlling your front door? Are you concerned about being able to see who's on the other side of that door before you open it? Can you open your door and get out your front door by yourself? And this helps to drill down to look at what devices then can help address those challenges.
Right. Thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Uh-huh.
This segment of our show, we'll hear from musician Howard Gripp. So tell me a little bit about some of the groups that your music might potentially be uplifting to.
A couple of my songs are about addiction. I have a couple of kids that battle with addiction, so I do play just some groups with addiction. I used to battle depression, so I focus on people with depression. And at one point in my life, I attempted to take my life. People that deal with suicide, those are kind of who I'm writing for.
So, when it comes to your own struggles, how have you found that music has been an outlet for you, help you cope with some of the harder times?
Music is everything to me. I mean, it can help you when you're happy, when you're sad. It can make you happy when you're sad. It can help you bring out emotions when you're struggling. You know, there's certain songs that can really tug at the heart. And I try to write, you know, most of my songs are about my past experiences, so I'm exposing my bad parts of my life to hopefully help other people that listen to the music to help them through whatever they're going through or hopefully ease their pain a little bit.
So, do you find that using music is kind of a cool, sort of relatable way to get a message of hope across as opposed to just a dry statistic?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a dry statistic may give you some kind of like a shock value, you know, but I think music can move you, can emotionally touch you. I just think there's music is a very powerful thing in anyone's life.
So how did you first get involved in the music scene?
I've been playing music my whole life. I used to be a rock and roll guy for many, 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 many years. I just converted to Christian music about 3 years ago. I've been surrounded by music. My mom was, as first out of the family, was very musical. And my brother's into music, and I've just been around my whole life.
So, as you've entered the world of Christian music, do you find that there's a need for songs of hope about things like addiction, depression, and this is a way to sort of start having those conversations?
Absolutely. I mean, it's amazing. You know, I've played thousands of rock and roll gigs, and, you know, when you talk to people afterwards, there's really no context to what you're talking about. When I play these gigs that I play now in the Christian venues and churches and coffee shops and things like that, festivals, you know, it's the people that come up and talk to you afterwards that do express how the music has touched them, or I do a lot of testimony in my shows too, or how the testimony has touched them through the music. I think it's extremely important. I think it's very powerful. Needed in today's society, for sure.
Are there any challenges in being so open and vulnerable, if you will, when it comes to putting that much of your story out there.
It's scary. I mean, when I first started doing Christian music, it was hard. It was very scary because, you know, it was almost like God was telling me to tell everybody how bad I was, you know, and tell everybody how bad I was. So it was tough. But I started to realize after talking to people after shows the reason that he had me doing it. You know, so now it's a very powerful tool to help people find hope and know that they're not, if they're lost, they can still be found.
So in your musical efforts, in this journey towards Christian music and uplifting others, is there any success moment or story you've experienced you'd like to share?
Yeah, when I was going down to Nashville to record my first two songs, I stopped at this place called The Gathering Place in Normal, Illinois, and they had Christian music on Friday night. And when I went in, I met the guy that runs it, Rick Rem, and he didn't have anything on the schedule yet. And I said, well, I'd like to try out sometime, see if I can play here. So I wrote my name down, and he read my name. He goes, Howard Griff. And I said, yeah. And he goes, do you have a song on Spotify called When I Pray about addiction? And I said, well, yeah, I do. And he said, I don't know how I found that song, but I listen to it all the time, every day. A bunch of these people in here tonight have listened to it because I'm a recovering addict. And the song is about addiction from a parent's perspective. And he said, I really never knew how my parents felt until I heard that song. It was super powerful.
So do you see yourself continuing to work with these groups and to continue to provide hope for the addictions and the depression community?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I wondered why God told me to do this at my age. I mean, I'm not a young chicken anymore. And this is everything I wanted to do when I was a kid, you know. And now that he's called me to it, and I've seen the hope that it can bring to people, yeah, I am definitely going to continue doing it for sure.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
Andy Link will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Drivers who use handheld devices such as cell phones are 4 times more likely to get into crashes serious enough to cause injury or even death. Brain injuries such as those caused by distracted driving kill more people under the age of 20 than any other causes combined. When you text and drive, you not only put your own life at risk, but the lives of others on the street around you. Go to leavethephonealone.ca, take the pledge to only drive and never text, and help to put an end to distracted driving. Everyone deserves to travel on our roads without fear.
Welcome back to HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Wendy Davis of the PA Assistive Technology Foundation and from musician Howard Gripp. In this segment of our show, Shelley Brazier will be telling us a little bit about the Geneva Center for Autism. So what can you tell me about the Geneva Center?
So Geneva Center for Autism is a not-for-profit agency in Toronto. We're in the Midtown area, kind of close to Yonge and Davisville, an agency that supports folks with an autism diagnosis or who consider themselves neurodivergent. We support the lifespan. So, you know, at our center, depending on the service that you access, it could be for children, youth, adults, older adults, caregivers, and others that are supporting those individuals with the diagnosis.
So how do you reach out to those who could potentially benefit from your work?
Pardon me, can you say that question again?
So how do you reach out to folks who could potentially benefit from the center's work?
Geneva Center has been around we just had our 50th anniversary last year in 2024, so we have been in the sector for a very long time, so our name does precede us a little bit. But I think, you know, in current day, definitely word of mouth. We are, as I mentioned before, have a wide variety of services for children, youth, and adults. And so, you know, one of our biggest is having caregivers or those adults themselves share their experiences that they've had with us with others. We're also quite unique in the services that we provide, so I think that brings people to us. We're one of the few agencies in Toronto, or maybe even in the province, that offers a high rate of services that are one-to-one, meaning many of our clients that are being supported by our programs, each client has their own dedicated staff. So they may work within a team, but this service at any one given point in time is a one-to-one service, which we find, at least we hear from caregivers, is really crucial. Often, you know, if you think about school context, kids are in a group context when you're in a classroom, even if it's a small classroom placement, or if they're coming for one of our respite, recreation, or our camp programs. Most agencies offer that in small groups. So you might have like one staff to three or four clients, whereas at Geneva Center, those offerings are majorly one-to-one. So we have one staff with one client, which means we are able to address the needs of those clients at a better rate, and we're also able, which is really important for us, to get out into the community. So we might have buildings, we might have an address, but often many of our services take the individual out into the community and experiencing what the community has to offer, which is really important.
So I'm curious, do you find that the one-to-one aspect helps dispel any myths or stereotypes concerning autism? Like, you can read about it in a broader sense, but to actually get to know an individual with autism would be a different experience.
I don't know if that one-to-one piece dispels any myths. I think from an operational point of view and a supportive point of view of the client, it does help us to get to know that client well, and it helps us to be able to address the needs of that, the unique needs of that client. Because, you know, as we know, any one person with autism is one person with autism. They don't all look the same or all have the same needs, even if they're the same age. You have a group of 10-year-olds, you know, within that group, the needs of each of those 10-year-olds are going to vary widely. So I think having that high staff ratio allows us to address each of their needs. And that doesn't mean when I say they're one-to-one, that they're always one child or adult or youth with one staff. They could be in a group context doing things with their peers in that service, but there is a staff there to address their needs as needed.
So
with behavioral, their, you know, day-to-day toileting, eating, those sort of things.
So in your time with the center, is there any success moment or story that stands out for you you'd like to share?
I mean, I think there's, I've been at the Geneva Center now, so I didn't introduce myself so well at the beginning, but I am one of the program directors here at Geneva Center. And I started as a frontline staff 19 or 20. Let's go with 19 because it's less. 19 years ago. And so I think in that time here, I've seen so many success stories. I think for me, especially in the role that I'm in now as director and not as close to that front line and seeing the clients, I'm not, you know, not a frontline staff and working directly with clients, but I do talk a lot with whether it's caregivers like moms, dads, grandparents, siblings, etc. And I love hearing the stories from them of around perhaps, you know, it doesn't even really matter age, but prior to coming to Geneva Center, being, you know, nervous and scared around their loved one's future, and then whatever service they might have, their loved one might have participated in, to see their own pride in their loved one as they start to gain skills or those really challenging disruptive behaviors that maybe they might have come in with are being reduced and replaced with more functional skills. Communication is coming. I remember a few years ago we toilet trained an adult, and that family really thought, you know, he's grown, he's an adult, never be able to get him toilet trained. And they had a good system going. He would kind of took him to the bathroom on a regular schedule, but he still required a favorite out to be in adult diapers and things like that. And we actually were able to get him toilet trained. So you see those pieces come together, not just for the clients. I think, you know, of course, you bring your loved one here, they're going to get, you know, high-quality services. We're going to work with the goals of the family and the needs of the client, but to see that trickle down into the siblings, the parents, and the impact on the entire family, I think for me is kind of the success story there.
So Do you have any hopes for the new year, things you'd like to achieve with the center?
I mean, it's a good question. We're just now thinking about, we're heading into our, you know, from a business point of view, heading into our last quarter of the current business year. And so our new quarter starts in April. So there's lots of conversations right now as to what do we want the next year to look like? What do we want to bring? And I think one of the things that Geneva Center is so very good at is being innovative, staying ahead of the curve, you know, addressing, staying with the times, even from a clinical lens as to what's new out there, what's the best way to serve our clients that is both clinically relevant, but also we do it with dignity and care. So I think we're just having those conversations right now where we just opened in the past year a new clinic that deals with extremely challenging and complex behavior. We kind of had a soft launch last year and just before the winter break had our official opening. So excited to sort of see where that takes us. Definitely that clinic, it's small in nature right now, but the clients coming through that have attempted to access services in other areas and have been deemed, you know, not a good fit due to their behavior. And so it's been nice over the past sort of 6 to 9 months to see some of those kids come through, be able to find new appropriate skills and reduce their challenging behavior. And now that they're done with us in that clinic, can go back to some of those services and actually access those services that they need because the behavior has been dealt with. So looking forward to sort of continue to build that that clinic and the resources in that clinic up and continue to serve those clients coming through there so they can actually access the services that they need long-term throughout their lifespan.
Light, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. Thanks. Friends, I always love stories of disabilities and music. For the fact is, people will ignore a statistic, but they won't ignore a story. If you can put a human face, a real life story, to someone's disability journey, that makes all the difference. What better way to do it than music? Music is, by its very nature, a story, a profound emotional impact on each one of us. The cool thing about that is, each one of us will interpret it just a little differently. But if we share someone's strength, their rise, their fall, their getting back up again, it's the sort of thing that tends to reach our hearts. This is especially true if we target a group that's marginalized, a group that needs to hear the message, or if they see themselves in a musical story. They can be uplifted. They can say, there is hope for my situation. There is at least the possibility that I can rise beyond all this. Someone out there is trying to tell me that my story, my circumstances matter. So, who am I not to listen? This isn't just true in the art world, my friends. When a person with a disability finds that focal point, that center, especially with acquired disabilities, and they find something meaningful and positive to focus on, some semblance of hope, their life begins to seem a little brighter. And little by little, they discover their own strength. Not just a strength that can be taken out on a field or into a classroom or even a job situation, but a strength that's overarching into every facet of who and what they are. That's what each one of us are looking for, I think. Truth is, everyone needs something in their life to remind them that the world has potential, that they have potential, that troubling circumstances today might not necessarily be situation of tomorrow. This has been Handy Link. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.
We're from the Kiwassa Preteen Spring Camp. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. Campus Community Radio from Simon Fraser University on Burnaby Mountain.